Some of you may have picked up on the fact that my sermon series title, Brave New World, is a direct stealing of the title of Aldous Huxley's novel from the early 20th century, Brave New World, which a title which by itself was a direct stealing from a line from Shakespeare's Tempest, O Brave New World. Brave New World was one of the early and influential examples of a particular kind of fiction, works of fiction that paint a picture of the future, sometimes a distant future, as in that book, 500-600 years in the future. Sometimes it is a close future, and sometimes it's even a parallel but different kind of reality for the time period in which it's written. And Huxley used the words bad utopia to describe the future he wrote about. Now, we now have another word for it that we use, dystopia, that distinguish between those two kinds of worlds different from the one in which we live. A utopia being blissfully or generally positive overall. Dystopia, a distorted and often a painfully different kind of future than the present. But usually in the most interesting versions, there are kind of a combination of those good and bad things. An apparent utopia, for example, having hidden horrors in it. And a dystopia forges unlikely heroes. And it's not just in literature, but other kinds of things like TV episodes from the Twilight Zone to Heroes to Falling Skies and Defiance. Movies like the original and the new incarnation of Planet of the Apes, Gattaca, I Am Legend, Elysium. Perhaps you can tell I have long been a fan of such things. Now, not all genres or all examples, but I do like many of them, many kinds of sci-fi and fantasy. Let's get a shout out for the Star Trekkers, the Trekkies. And I know we have the Star Wars aficionados. I'm looking right at you. And those who embrace both. Now, I enjoy them because I enjoy this opportunity to explore a reality different than the one in which we may currently live. And I have confessed in recent months that one of my current favorites that I'm chomping at the bit for the new season to begin is Walking Dead on AMC. Yeah, oh yes, it's true. I like me some zombie. I don't quite understand it. That may be deserving of a whole other sermon or therapy. But Walking Dead is one of my current favorites. And it is set either in the very near future or really a parallel time to our own because the features are so similar, but it is following the zombie apocalypse, which has swept certainly the US and almost certainly the world. Now, so many of these are set following some kind of apocalypse of zombies or alien invasions, or it's somehow technology gone rogue, murderous robots or genetically engineered viruses have gotten loose. That some kind of widespread disaster has befallen the world. And this new world looks like this, whatever is imagined. It is interesting to notice that such world-changing disasters, imagined or real, we call apocalypses, an apocalypse. Now, the word apocalypse even now defines a universal or widespread disaster, but the original Greek word, apocalypse, spelled a little differently, means revelation. You'll find the final book of the Bible in some versions called not just the Revelation of John, but the Apocalypse of John. They are interchangeable. Revelation, or even more simply, to uncover, to reveal, to unveil. So I think one of the reasons I enjoy this sci-fi, fantasy, futuristic stuff is because they are an exercise, a commentary, even parables of an alternative way of looking at our own world, our own social systems, human nature and morality. And they are good for entertainment value, but they also reveal essential truths if they're really good. So in The Walking Dead, for example, I'll soon be off of this. I'll soon be done with The Walking Dead. No, I'll never be done with The Walking Dead. For example, you see very unpredictable people rising to the occasion with a kind of heroism that in their previous life and world would never have been called upon. A pizza delivery man shows out to be one of the most clever and resourceful of the survivors. And folks that survived in the previous world do not bode well in the future world. They can be overly naive or dependent upon the system. It's really interesting to see who just shows up to be more well-suited for which kind of world. And as it goes on, the essential character of each is more and more revealed. An apocalypse reveals something that is otherwise hidden, and it reveals the essential character of things. So as a sermon series, A Brave New World, perhaps the apocalypse is the end of what I call churchianity and the birth of something new. It is about a kind of apocalypse for Christianity. It may not be as cataclysmically sudden as a nuclear war or an alien invasion, but decades of observers and study after study of the trends of Christianity have shown one conclusion. It's kind of like global warming. Long-standing ways of doing things as an institution, what I call churchianity and others call churchianity, these ways are declining and ending and giving way. Dominant Christianity in U.S. Protestantism, in all of its denominational forms, is losing influence, and it's giving way to something new. While it's still a majority, 70%, down 7 to 8% in only 7 years, churchianity is losing its pride of place and its privilege as a dominant form of Christianity. We, here at the beginning of the 21st century, whether we like it or not, we live in a uniquely difficult and powerful moment in Christian history. Last week, I used Phyllis Tickle's metaphor of the rummage sale that happens every 500 years in Christian history. It's right on time for right now. We're in the midst of the rummage sale. The end of churchianity, let us be clear, is not the end of Christianity, if by that we mean followers of the path of Jesus Christ. But it does mean that close to nearly 15 centuries of privilege and dominance of the church are giving way. It also means that traditional long-standing ways of doing things are being shed and discarded. It is a shift that is a change that is so widespread that we are stepping into a new world. And like in every apocalypse, the true nature of things will come to light. It will reveal what has gone awry and what is good and necessary and essential. So there are a few clues as to what this post-apocalyptic Christianity might look like. There are some clues, and one of the clearest and most pervasive ones is this. The followers of Jesus here and now are getting ready for the future by looking to the past, and not just the distant past of what it was like in the 19th or the 18th or even the 15th century. We are looking back to a time before the church was an institution, before it had any pride of position or dominance, and was a movement, that pre-Constantinian Christianity. If you remember early world history or early Christian history, in the first century, a few at and around the ministry and death of Jesus, the followers of Jesus were this ragtag group. And over the course of decades, under the careful watch of first Jewish authorities and then the Roman Empire, they grew more or less and flourished as this disorganized, argumentative, not always agreeing on everything group of folks, but they became something that needed to be dealt with by the Roman government in many ways. All over the close-in Mediterranean and Middle East. Now, in those 2.5 centuries, they were subject to sporadic or local persecution because they were such a departure from the culture and expectation of the empire. And the most widespread persecution happened in important date, 311, only 2 years, actually the Emperor Diocletian in 311. And it was in 313, the beginning of the 4th century, your history lesson is soon over. Constantine decriminalized. It was criminal in the Roman Empire to be a Christian. In the early 4th century, when it was decriminalized by the Emperor Constantine, was the beginning of a shift. By the end of that century, 70 years later, in 380, it was the religion of the empire. It was the official religion. Just think about it for a moment. In the living memory of one person, from 311 to 380, that person could have witnessed their parents being thrown to the beasts in the arena because of their religion, to their religion being the religion of the empire, an empire that had killed its founder only a few hundred years before. That's a big shift. And who can blame some to think that was the hand of God at work? The end of persecutions is a good thing, but marriage to the empire, not so much a good thing. The future for followers of Jesus and the church looks a lot more like the ancient past, not our recent past. The living before and now, as we're living into this loss of privilege, loss of dominance, and loss of worldly power. And let's face it, given the way Jesus describes his followers as salt and yeast and light and anawim, which means little, lowly ones, we should ask if ever the followers of Jesus should have been married to the empire. So there are all kinds of specific practices and characteristics. Lots of studies, people like Phyllis Tickle, Diana Butler Bass, Brian McLaren, Shane Claiborne. But I want to commend to you something that I read just this week, and it is 41 pages long and very easy and insightful. John Schweibert, one of the founders of Metanoia Peace Community, you recognize that name because that's the husband of our Pat Schweibert. They founded Metanoia Peace Community with others in 1986. And John has written this lovely essay, really helpful, 10 characteristics for emergent churches is the word he uses. 10 practices, and what's really striking and insightful, he uses Greek words to describe those 10 practices. The same important move, saying the future of the church is dependent upon remembering its ancient past. 10 things like ecclesia, the nature of church itself is different. Metanoia. We know it as repentance, but we often misunderstand that turning of one's mind and a life. Diakonia, serving others, 10 of them. I commend it to you. You can get it at the Peace House, and I bet Pat Schweibert could find out how to get more copies as well. So, a terrific read. I commend it to you. But what is so insightful about all of these studies that illuminate things from the ancient past? None of the qualities or characteristics are foreign to our Christian spiritual path. They have been here all along, expressed different ways, but just not in the celebrated, powerful, dominant ways. If that interests you, another book by Diana Butler Bass, People's History of Christianity, tells it beautifully. We're learning that what we need to move into the future is something we've always had, and perhaps it has needed an apocalypse to unveil it for us, and a rummage sale to get rid of what we don't need. It's a process of discovering who we are, actually remembering who we are, a reversal of sorts. Another thing that Diana Butler Bass says, a reversal, because in order to tell a different story with a different outcome, sometimes we have to reverse the script. And we have an example.
I am part of a lost generation, and I refuse to believe that I can change the world. I realize this may be a shock, but happiness comes from within is a lie. Money will make me happy. So in 30 years, I will tell my children they are not the most important thing in my life. My employer will know that I have my priorities straight because work is more important than family. I tell you this, once upon a time, families stayed together, but this will not be true in my era. This is a quick fix society. Experts tell me 30 years from now, I will be celebrating the 10th anniversary of my divorce. I do not conceive that I will live in a country of my own making. In the future, environmental destruction will be the norm. No longer can it be said that my peers might care about this earth. It will be evident that my generation is apathetic and lethargic. It's foolish to presume that there is hope. And this will all be true unless we reverse it. There is hope. It is foolish to presume that my generation is apathetic and lethargic. It will be evident that my peers might care about this earth. No longer can it be said that environmental destruction will be the norm. In the future, I will live in a country of my own making. I do not concede that 30 years from now, I will be celebrating the 10th anniversary of my divorce. Experts tell me this is a quick fix society, but this will not be true in my era. Families stayed together once upon a time. I tell you this, family is more important than work. I have my priorities straight because my employer will know they are not the most important. So in 30 years, I will tell my children, money will make me happy is a lie. Happiness comes from within. I realize this may be a shock, but I can change the world, and I refuse to believe I am part of a lost generation.
What happens when we flip the script? The same content, different order. One, despair and hopelessness. The other, life and hope. Have we always had what we needed for life and for hope and for beauty? We just need to get it in the right priority of order. In her book, from which we hear that excerpt today, Christianity After Religion, Diana Butler Bass identifies three components, really a threefold path to following Jesus. And handily, for preaching purposes, thank you, Diana Butler Bass, she uses three B's: believing, behaving, and belonging. Three things that have always been in evidence in the path and the communities that have followed Jesus. Believing, behaving, and belonging. And all have been part of the journey all along, but we've misunderstood them and got them in the wrong order. When we hear the word believe, we tend to think of dogmas or theological doctrines that we are expected to more or less sign on the dotted line here. When we hear the word behave in a church context, makes me shudder a little bit, we think it's rules that tell you you can or cannot behave in a certain way, a list of do's or don'ts. Belong, well, once you have signed on the dotted line of belief, once you act in the way we have told you should act, then you're part of the club. Then you belong. Believe, behave, belong. Well, one of the things we've gotten wrong about belief in the modern era, it was never meant to be about intellectual opinions, but an expression of heartfelt trust and loyalty. You know, the word believe is from an old English word, belieben, which sounds very German because it is, to prize, to treasure, to hold dear. And it comes from that German word, Liebe, which is love. Belief, in its original form, in its native and ancient form, moves away. It is not about rational content, but experiential and love and trust. Christianity was never meant to be a system or structure of, quote, beliefs as we say them. It was and has always best been a disposition of one's heart. Behave, not a list of rules to do and not do, but practices the doing of faith. It's through imitation and instruction, through mentoring in proven practices, that we learn by doing how our being is transformed. We close the gap between who we are and who we want to be. There was a whole sermon series about this during Lent. You can find it on the website. That was not really a commercial, but it just popped out that way. That was the theme of Lent here at MCC Portland. Believing, behaving, belonging, a sense of relatedness, your identity and your being, you become a part of something larger. But belonging, interestingly enough, is a locating question. Where am I? Whose am I? Who am I in God? It's a location and a locating and a relational question. They're in and with statements. It shifts from some kind of formal membership in an institution for which you get a certificate to who you are in God through Christ with others toward the kingdom of God. So what she points out is, for at least 500 years, our recent ancestors in churchianity have said, you believe first, you behave a certain way, and then you belong. We will be in relationship with you. But the truth of the matter is, that's not how it was meant to be. Relationship comes first. Come here, follow me. Which leads to practices and action, and then experiential belief. She describes that path that we heard in the reading today. It's the path of the New Testament, the way of Jesus that leads to God. It's in the past 500 years or so we have reversed the order. It's our job to return it to its correct order. Belong. It's the relationship first. Behave. Practice it. Do it in the world. And then, you may experience something worth believing. I picked the excerpt from Paul's first letter to the church in Corinth. And that reading is probably very, very familiar to many people in this room. It is most commonly any longer heard at wedding ceremonies. And even on those occasions of wedding ceremonies where I'm asked to say a few words in some sort of homily, I remind, even in a wedding, that the original setting of these beautiful words that we now associate with romantic and coupled love most frequently, that was not the context in which Paul was writing them. It's applicable to a couple and a family as community, but he was writing to a contentious community that was in conflict, the church in Corinth. They were arguing about who is more important than the other, whose gifts are more spectacular than the other, who is right and who is wrong. And this stems from his way of saying, as good and as important as all of those gifts are, there is something that is always more important, against which all of them are judged. And he launches into this exalted hymn to love. And if you read it and recall it, as he describes it, if we set aside the wash of warm feelings that come over us when we hear the words, he's not talking about warm, fuzzy feelings. He's talking about actions that are actually very hard to do in community and with someone even that you profess to love, but sometimes it's hard to be patient or kind. and not envious, boastful, arrogant, or rude. Not just in marriages. Does not insist upon its own way, is not irritable or resentful. Oh, that's a hard one. Is that love not irritable and resentful? I have work to do. Rejoices in truth, not in wrongdoing. It is hard work. So I selected this passage because at the end of the day, it is a reminder that the church, in whatever its form, Christianity following the ways of Jesus, be it the church of the past or the future, it is not likely to be judged powerful or successful by standards that are dominant. It will be judged successfully, a group of followers of Jesus, if it is a school for loving. I'll say that again. It will not be judged successful by the standards of power of the dominant society. It will be judged successful because it is a school of love. Sisters and brothers, as unpredictable, as uncertain, as scary even, as this apocalypse may be, we have always had what we needed to face this brave new world. Belonging, behaving, believing, the practice, the hard practice of love. Just too often, they've lain hidden underneath all the other unnecessary things. Now is the day to reclaim them, because now is the time they are being revealed.